Saul reigned 1 year, and when he had reigned 2 years over Israel, Saul chose for himself 3,000 men of Israel. 2,000 were Saul in Michmash and in the mountains of Bethel, and 1,000 were of Jonathan in Gibeah of Benjamin. The rest of the people he sent away, every man to his tent. And Jonathan attacked the garrison of the Philistines that was in Geba, and the Philistines heard of it. Then Saul blew the trumpet throughout the land, saying, "Let the Hebrews hear." Now all of Israel heard it said that Saul had attacked a garrison of the Philistines, and that Israel had also become an abomination to the Philistines. And the people were called together to Saul at Gilgal. Then the Philistines gathered together to fight with Israel, 30,000 chariots and 6,000 horsemen, and people as the sand which is on the seashore in multitude. And they came up and encamped in Michmash to the east of Beth Aven. When the men of Israel saw that they were in danger, for the people were distressed, then the people hid in caves, in thickets, in rocks, in holes, and in pits. And some of the Hebrews crossed over the Jordan to the land of Gad and in Gilead. As for Saul, he was still in Gilgal, and all the people followed him, trembling. Then he waited 7 days according to the time set by Samuel, but Samuel did not come to Gilgal, and the people were scattered from him. So Saul said, "Bring a burnt offering and peace offerings here to me." And he offered the burnt offering. Now it happened, as soon as he had finished offering the burnt offering, that Samuel came, and Saul went out to meet him, that he might greet him. And Samuel said, "What have you done?" And Saul said, "When I saw that the people were scattered from me, and that you did not come within the days appointed, and that the Philistines gathered together at Michmash, then I said, 'The Philistines will now come down on me at Gilgal, and I have not made supplication to the Lord.' Therefore I felt compelled and offered a burnt offering." And Samuel said to Saul, "You have done foolishly. You have not kept the commandment of the Lord your God, which he commanded you. For now the Lord would have established your kingdom over Israel forever. But now your kingdom shall not continue. The Lord has sought for himself a man after his own heart, and the Lord has commanded him to be a commander over his people, because you have not kept what the Lord commanded you." Then Samuel arose and went up from Gilgal to Gibeah of Benjamin, and Saul numbered the people who were present with him, about 600 men. Saul, Jonathan, his son, and the people who were present with them remained in Gibeah of Benjamin, but the Philistines encamped in Michmash. The raiders came out of the camp of the Philistines in three companies. One company turned to the road that leads to Ophrah, to the land of Shual. Another company turned to the road to Beth Horon, and another company turned to the road of the border that overlooks the valley of Zeboim toward the wilderness. Now there was no blacksmith to be found throughout all the land of Israel, for the Philistines said, "Lest the Hebrews make swords and spears." But all the Israelites would go down to the Philistines to sharpen each man's plowshare, his mattocks, his axe, and his sickle. And the charge for a sharpening was a pim for the plowshares, the mattocks, and the forks, and the axes, and to set the points of the goads. So it came about on the day of battle that there was neither a sword nor spear found in the hand of any of the people who were with Saul and Jonathan, but they were found with Saul and Jonathan, his son. And the garrison of the Philistines went out to the pass of Michmash. Now it happened on the day that Jonathan, the son of Saul, said to the young man who bore his armor, "Come, let us go over to the Philistines' garrison that is on the other side." But he did not tell his father. And Saul was sitting on the outskirts of Gibeah under the pomegranate tree, which is in Migron. The people who were with him were about 600 men. Ahiah, the son of Ahitub, Ichabod's brother, the son of Phinehas, the son of Eli, the Lord's priest in Shiloh, was wearing an ephod, but the people did not know that Jonathan had gone.
Thank you, Hank, for reading 1 Samuel 13 through 14, verse 3. There are a couple of interesting things that happened in this chapter in the three verses. First of all, are there any questions or comments that caught your attention that I can address? Yes, Ellie.
Well, verse 11, certainly the sin of presumption that David warns about in the Psalms. Save me from the sin of presumption because it's a great evil. And we look at what we do as sin. If we don't do as sin, but there's both sides. Don't do what you're not supposed to do just because you think it's the right thing to do.
Very true. Very true. We're going to get into that a little more detailed as far as what Saul did and why he did it. But it's a great point. Any other? Yes, Tammy.
Well, it goes back to maybe the idea that there are right things to do, but it doesn't mean it's your right to do them.
That's true. That does happen as well. Any other comments? Yes, John.
That he waited until the set amount of time.
Set amount of time, correct.
But maybe he didn't wait until the exact end of the set amount of time.
We discussed that as well, the exact timing which Samuel was referring to when he said 7 days. Any other comments or questions? Yes, Ellie.
Well, there's a story in Matthew about someone delaying his coming.
Yes.
And sometimes we get carried away because...
It doesn't delay it by very much, just a little bit.
You don't have to delay it much to mess it up.
Yep, yep. Yes, Nathaniel.
Maybe he also showed fear of the enemy instead of fear of the Lord.
Very well put. Absolutely true. He did show fear of his enemy as opposed to what he was supposed to be doing. He lost focus.
Yeah.
Any other comments or questions? This is a very deceptively simple chapter. I mean, I cannot emphasize that enough. Are there any comments?
Daniel.
Yes, Carrie.
I'm thinking, do you think the greeting that he gave Samuel afterwards was different from... It's just Samuel immediately says, what have you done?
Right.
You know?
Right. Like, Samuel knows something went wrong.
I wonder, it could be that God just told him Saul had done something, but I wonder if there was something in Saul's manner that...
Something which Samuel is trained to pay attention to. He knew ahead of time, and because he can detect those certain things before they arrive, which we discussed about what the sacrifices are that Saul did versus ones he did not do. Yes, Tammy.
Well, think about it. I mean, if this offering was a burnt offering,
it was.
I mean, Samuel showing up in the aftermath of it is like, wait a minute.
I smell some burnt meat. Very true. That's exactly. I mean, Samuel knows what a burnt offering is, and you can smell a burnt. And this, I don't recall what animal it specified. I believe it was an ox. Ah, crud, I forgot. Well, anyway, whichever animal he chose, I believe it was an ox. Burning up an entire animal that size is going to make a lot of smoke for a large distance to come, and many people can smell it for many miles around because it's such a large animal. So, any other questions or comments? Yes, Susan.
I mean, I could just imagine Saul's face. I mean, he probably just like, I'm guilty.
Very true.
Freaking out.
Yeah, exactly. Uh-oh, what did I do?
Yeah.
All right.
Just a
Hector.
Maybe kind of in my ignorance here, but regarding these burnt offerings, especially with the bowl put on there, do they burn these things to charcoal smithereens or?
It depends which type of offering. Yeah. This particular one would have been a burnt up one.
Yeah, totally burnt.
Totally burnt. There's in certain parts of it you're not allowed to burn. I think the internal guts and parts that you have to bury those. But the rest of it, the meat, you pretty much burn. The hide, I don't think you burn the hide either. If I recall correctly.
So they're skinned?
Yeah, they're skinned.
Oh.
And not all offerings are that way. Particular ones were. And this is one of them that would have been skinned ahead of time.
Who says that in Leviticus?
Yeah, sorry. I can go through that, but the Leviticus is four or five chapters describes each offering, its name, and how you procedurally follow each one of them and when you do them. There are burnt offerings, which are completely consumed up, and then there are peace offerings, which that's what we classify as a barbecue.
Okay.
You cook it, it's edible, we all eat, have a good meal, and then move on. There are different offerings. Peace offerings is the most common one done, for obvious reasons, because it's fun and everybody likes to eat. But the burnt offering is also done very frequently as well.
So was it more of a sin offering?
No, sin offerings are a separate issue. We're going through the book of Leviticus, the Torah's job, which in this case is going to be Richard. When he gets there, he has to go through a whole book of Exodus. But it's a very detailed, orientated procedures, and that's one of the reasons why you have a priest do it, because the priests know the procedures. They don't mess them around. Okay. Any questions or comments? Okay. And for those of you who cannot see my little handy-dandy map, my map has two parts to it. The bottom half is the battle scene that we're actually going to be talking with, the various different towns and cities that are occurring. The top half is a really blown-out view of the Mediterranean Sea. Yeah, a little Rome and Italy up here, and Greece and Troy and Athens, and which we'll get to this half. The top half we'll get to later. The bottom half we're going to focus on right now. But I have to cover both because both are extremely relevant to this particular chapter, though they may not seem that way. When Hank read verse 1, I know it's one start of verse 1, might as well. His wording, if I recall from this Bible, records that Saul reigned 1 year, and then in his second year, he does this battle for the Philistines. Well, unfortunately, the Hebrew words and phrase in this verse are extremely difficult to translate into English, because they're awkwardly placed, and the words don't mean what we think they mean. And we try to place them in the sequence, we try to make logical sentences, you come up with multiple different answers. So each of them has their own variation as far as what's actually going on here. The variation mine happens to record down, which is nothing really fancy. It's just a traditional Jewish variation. It specifies that it was in the first year of Saul's reign, and before he reigned 2 years. That's what mine records down. The actual Hebrew says Saul was 1 year old. And that's basically it's actually 1 year old. He's not a year old. The man's over 40 at this point because he has a son, Jonathan, who's a military man who's at least be over 20. So he's got to be at least a certain minimum age. But he's not that young. But you know, that's how mine records it. Now some record it whether it was in the second year or first year is debatable. I'm not going to argue whether one's absolutely right or absolutely wrong. Yes, Tammy.
Yeah, most of our Bibles will say Saul was 30 years old when he began to reign. He reigned 42 years. But the interesting thing is that 40 is in italics.
Yes, because he didn't.
And it's relative. 42 years in.
Right. Simple. 40 years, but that was because David was anointed king in Saul's second year. Saul's no longer king once David gets anointed as king. Now, David was a young man.
He didn't take over.
But God's the one who dictates who a king is. And David didn't reign as king at that point in time when he was anointed, meaning he wasn't a ruler that everybody recognized him as king, but that's the point which he was anointed within Saul's second year. We don't know whether it was early second year or late second year. Either way, it was second year. And when you go back to a timeline of sequences, all right, kings, age is a king, they lived, they died, they lived, they died, and go back, you notice there's an acute small gap left for Saul's reign. The gap is not 40-year-wide gap. It's down, some argue it's a 3-year gap, some argue it's a 1-year gap between Saul and Samuel before him. So it's a very narrow slot of time which Saul is allowed to be king, or reigned as king. Okay, just want to say that to the different variations. Whether it's first, second year, it doesn't really matter. The point, it was very early on in his kingship. Verse 2. Saul dismisses all but about 3,000 guys. Now, unlike previous sections of the Bible, the term Eleph, which we say, oh, well, it means clan versus thousand, that clan and thousand distinction disappears when you reach the kings. Eleph means thousand. Once you reach them, Saul's point forward, Eleph is 1,000 people, 1,000 human beings. It's a quantity. Prior to him, during the judge's time, that Eleph just meant a family, a group. It could be 1,000, it could be 10. It didn't make any difference. It was just a group. So the definitions became more distinct here. So Saul dismisses all about 3,000 people. Some were with Jonathan, his son, some were with Saul. This is commonly pointed out that if Saul dismissed He had roughly, they say, about 600,000 men when he was conquering the earlier in that year, conquering Ammon. Does it dismiss this many soldiers back into scattered amongst Israel? Lots and lots of soldiers gone. Why would Saul's son, Jonathan, provoke a battle when he has so few people left? He wouldn't. Why would he do that? That's craziness. You don't do that. You don't provoke a battle with somebody who's 10 times your size, actually in this case more like 20 times your size, when you are hopelessly outnumbered. But yet, Jonathan does it anyway. We'll discuss a little bit more about Jonathan as we get through. He does a couple of things, quite unique individual. We'll discuss a lot of things about him. He's not one who is normally covered in a lot of stories and information about him. He's just Jonathan. Oh, he's David's friend. He's Saul's son. That's about all you know about him. Well, there's a reason why David and Jonathan were so close friends. They're very similar in nature. This is an act I would have expected from David. Because David had done this act. Very similar ones with a few guys. And okay, yeah, you outnumber me 10-1. Okay, I'll kill you anyway. He goes and does it. It's a very bold belief and following of what God wants. And David understood that. Jonathan does as well. Jonathan's only Achilles heel that he cannot be king because Saul is his dad. Had Saul not been his dad, God easily could have chosen a man after his own heart and included Jonathan amongst that category of people. Very similar in nature to David. But Jonathan has a pedigree problem in that his father was already king, and God said, it will not be extended beyond you, so tough luck. But that's okay. So Saul dismisses all but a few thousand people. So 1,000 or so with Jonathan. Now my little map, I know most of you can't see it, but I'll raise it up just a little bit so you can see. I have the main part of Benjamin's territory, because Saul is Benjamite. Michmash, or Michmas, is the same city. It's a small little town here. It's north of Ramah and Geba. Geba is what we call Gibeah of Benjamin. It's the same name for the same town. They're right next to Ramah. You can literally probably throw out a rock and hit the other city of the town. It's like Rota Park and Santa Rosa, Rota Park and Cotati around here. It's practically the same town. Or you go to Los Angeles, they're like 1,000,001 cities in one little square foot. I mean, it's all over the place. So we have these little two towns really close together. And what does Jonathan do? In Gibeah of Benjamin. What does he do? Come on, we just read it.
He attacked the garrison.
He attacked somebody. Who did he kill?
Garrison of the Philistines.
Commander, actually. Particular commander of him. Commander of the garrison of the Philistines. He slew him. He killed a man. Now, I must ask you, how far is Gibeah of Benjamin, or Gibeah where he killed the guy, from Philistine territory? A little further than that. It's actually quite a distance. Actually, yeah, 4 inches on a map.
Yeah.
It's a long distance. As far as the point is that the Philistines had actually come into Israel's territory by a large distance. At this point in time, the Philistines had occupied a majority of southern Israel. Most of Judah, most of Benjamin, most of Ephraim, and all of Dan. They occupied it. They ruled it. Why? Well, wasn't Samuel judge? Didn't God say, oh, well, as long as you're judge, you know, Philistines won't be there, won't pester us? Well, that may be the case, but reality is the Philistines still had influence. They still traveled quite a distance in. So in Geba, which everybody knew who the Philistine garrison commander was, Jonathan comes along with his sword, amongst the two swords that actually exist in Israel at this point in time, because Saul and Jonathan are people who have swords, he kills a man. He kills a very important man, a man whose job it is to pay tribute, to make sure tribute is collected from all of Israel and make sure they, you know, they pay the taxes and do all the various rules, and brings it back to Philistines. That's his task. Apparently he's very good at it, because Philistines were quite upset. Maybe they lost a good chunk of money, I don't know. So Jonathan kills a man. He came over next to Robert. And Saul, who we presume was not planning this, because he says just few men. Alright, so it doesn't appear that Saul had told Jonathan, oh hey, you'll go kill this guy. It appears it's more of it's on Jonathan's accord. He chose to do so, because he knew it was the right thing to do. provoke a war because, yeah, we have kings now. Let's go ahead and do it. Well, Jonathan did so. Saul, whether he knew or not, it's debatable. Saul runs and blows the shofar throughout the whole land of Israel. For what?
Alarm.
Alarm. What are you allowed to do when you hear a shofar blast? Anybody remember?
Fear.
Assemble. You fear. Listen. You gather. You're also allowed to flee. Warnings. See, we think of shofars, oh, blow the shofar, get all your military gear together, let's go to battle. Well, yeah, that's not always the case. You are not required to go to battle when you hear a shofar blast. Yes, John.
Was there any kind of a distinction in the blasts or the notes? Or
there is distinction in the notes, but there's not distinction from calling to war and fleeing. Those distinctions are the same. Because it's up to you as an individual choice. Will I stay and fight? Will I flee with my family or whatever is needed? Because in some cases, if I'm, for example, a man with a wife and a whole bunch of kids, if I go and fight and die, who takes care of my family?
Nobody.
Nobody. Now, if I'm a man with kids and I have 4 or 5 sons that are of military age, they go off and fight, what do I do? I might go with them, or I might stay home and take care of their children, their wives, and get my family or their families to safety. So it's okay to flee. That's not a problem. God doesn't command thee, thou shalt fight when I blast a shofar. No, you shall respond. Respond appropriately. Some of you may fight. Some of you may have to flee. It doesn't matter which one you do. The point is, you're warned. There's no stigmatism against fleeing when it's in your circumstances to do the proper choices to flee.
And if you initially flee, you can turn around and come back.
You can easily come back. Once you get your family safe, you're allowed to return. There's no rule against that either. So he blasts the shofar around. This is verse 3. And of course, all the people say, oh, hey, Saul killed the slain. Well, all right. We already know the records that Jonathan killed it. But the people are saying, well, Saul killed it. Why? Because Jonathan's Saul's son. Well, would have presumed that Saul would have told Jonathan to go do this. Although based upon Saul's later on actions would indicate Saul did not intend to do this at all. He didn't intend to kill anybody. It was not but the fact he dismissed such a large percentage of his army. So it appears that Jonathan did this on his own accord, which reminds me of what David would have done. Goes to Gibeah, kills this guy. They go around, tell everybody else. Verse 8. Go to verse 8 here. It says in verse 8, excuse me, actually let's go to verse 7. Let's read verse 7 first. This required that Hebrews that were fleeing. Some of the Hebrews even crossed the Jordan, the land of Gad and Gilead, which is the other side of the Jordan, of course, which is much more safe, out of the Philistines' territory. Saul was still in Gilgal, which Saul had actually, he was in Mishpat, but he returned to Gilgal to gather his army together. So people began to disband from him. This is Saul's Achilles heel. He is a very, well, lack of a better term, a realist. He focuses on what is around him. Not that that's necessarily wrong, but he does focus on what's around him. Jonathan is not. Jonathan doesn't care what's around him. He does it anyway. Different types of people. The fact that one is his son is quite odd, but clearly one was trained or has a different spirit amongst him than his father did. So Saul's a realist. He sees the 7 days, the prescribed days from Samuel. Now, where do these days come from? 7 days. So where do we get that 7 days from? That's interpreted. No, the rules that Samuel gave him.
Right.
7 days. 7 days you will wait. That was over a year, and some argue 2 years ago. How is it that Saul knew that at this point in time he was supposed to wait 7 days, but he wasn't supposed to wait 7 days any of the times he went to Gilgal?
Told him.
Who told him?
Samuel.
What, did Samuel know that Jonathan was going to kill the garrison? Kill the commander? Did God tell him?
How
do you figure it out?
Is it a point in time?
Is it a point in time? Which point is it? No, I was going to say high day. It's an event that was occurring. Each of the other times that Saul went to Gilgal, Samuel was always with him in the journey to there. This is the first occurrence where Saul has to go to Gilgal alone. He wasn't with him. That's how Saul knew. I'm here. I'm going to Gilgal by myself. Every other time, Samuel's always been with me. But now I have to go there, and he never goes to Gilgal without Samuel. Thus, he must wait. That's how he knew. I'm here without Samuel. I'm not allowed to do anything without Samuel. Why is that? Because Samuel was the spiritual leader of the entire nation of Israel. What is Saul? A military guy. Samuel outranks Saul. Yes, Saul was anointed as a ruler. Not as a king, but as a ruler. But Samuel is the one who anointed him, and Samuel can, quote, un-anoint him. End quote. But he does. That's how Saul knew. It was the only time he had to go there alone. With, of course, all of his men. So Saul goes there. He waits for 7 days. Now, of course, we have his armies disbanding. His 2,000 guys that are with him, actually 3,000, because Jonathan joins him at this point in time. So all 3,000 are there at Gilgal. They scatter down and dwindle. They all run. What are they stuck with? 600 men. And Saul's waiting. Why are they stuck with 600 men? Why are all these people running away? Well, let's think about this.
The army's coming.
Yeah. What is the acute problem if you have an army and other guys have an army and you have no tools to fight with?
Run.
Yeah, they're bigger, you run.
Bye.
It's pretty simple. Pretty simple. Israel, however, had a very unique weapon at this point in time. Not say it was only for Israel, but it was I say unique is not the right word. And atypical. Available, commonly available for anyone, but few people ever used it. It's the same tool that David uses.
Slingshot?
It's a shepherd's sling. Shepherd's sling. Now, well, okay, what shepherd's sling? So what? Well, shepherd's slings, unlike their cousins that we have seen in most of our, you know, pictures and videotapes of people having slings, the shepherd's sling of the Mediterranean style, which actually is more Greek, Israelite, and Assyrian, is a little bit different than that of the Western Mediterranean, which is what we are commonly familiar with. The shepherd's sling at that point in time is not this tiny little tool that you see from the Palestinians in their, you know, this little foot and a half long little sling and they throw rocks. No. That's a child's toy. The Assyrians have military, what we call archers. You know, they shoot bows and arrows, banks and banks of them. You've seen that in movies and whatnot, right? Oh, thousands or hundreds of archers all shooting arrows. Well, same thing with slings. But they're not these little tiny things. They're normal-sized ones, which is about that long. Well, the reason is that from your hand, in this position, the sling cannot hit the ground. If it hits the ground, well, you obviously you mess it up. So you're about 2.5 to 3 feet in length of these slings. Well, that's not just the unique thing about them, because the Western or Eastern Mediterranean had a unique ammunition. Those of you who are familiar with my story or my little presentation on the menorah will be very familiar with this term. Shochet.
Almonds,
yes. Teardrop shape.
Your bullets.
What happens when you... first of all, those of you who are unfamiliar with this, a shepherd's sling is, of course, used for shepherds. Their task when they use the sling is to do nothing more than kill lions who attack their flock. A single shot will kill a lion.
Impressive.
That's actually quite impressive of a throw.
A lot of high-powered rifles.
Exactly. Now, they don't use the small little bullets the high-powered rifles use. They use stones. Now, what's the deal with the stone? The stones are most commonly used, not like they actually found most of these, or good copies of them, are between 4 to 6 ounces. How much does a bullet weigh?
120 grams?
Yeah, that's not even close. Now, the deal is, if Now me, I am not a shepherd. Okay, I cannot throw very far, very fast. If I'm best day, I might throw a ball like 30 miles an hour if I'm really, really good. Okay, 35 if I was great.
You're swinging it over your head.
That's not how you throw a sling.
No.
No. Not this kind. You can't swing it like this. Why? Because you hit the guy next to you. The proper way in which you demonstrate a sling, let's say, for example, those of you who are on this videotape, I apologize. There's a door in front of me about, though, maybe 10 plus feet away. If I'm looking straight at the door, I will not hit it with my sling. If I'm throwing it properly. I don't look at the door. I look 30 degrees off the door. So the door is to my left shoulder. So I'm looking more like, in this case, you know, 30 degrees off. I'm 60 degrees off from the door. Anyway. I don't spin the thing around my head because I'm going to hit the guy next to me. The sling is facing down near the ground where my hand is. It's a single throw. I bring it up, this is you with a baseball, and release. It is the most accurate, fastest way, because you have to reload immediately, of throwing a rock. It will hit your target. I'm 60 degrees off, because that's the way my arm's going to throw. I can throw my body into the throw, it will hit it very quickly. Now, like I said, I'm a very slow thrower. I'm not very good at it. However, if I was a shepherd, which most Israelites were at this point in time, I would be very familiar with slings. And what would I do when my sheep is flocking, eating stuff while I'm bored?
Practicing.
I'm practicing. So they have estimated, it's just an estimate, I don't know how accurate they actually are, if an average person can throw their rock 30, 35 miles an hour, let's say they all threw it 30, 35 miles an hour, but I have now a 3-foot extension on my arm. I'm going well over 150 miles an hour rock.
And the major league ball pitchers, they can throw those softballs or baseballs at 90
miles. Yeah, you can kill a man quite readily with those.
That's why they get in such big trouble in the accident.
Yes, and hit people, exactly.
There's a big penalty
for them. So this Mediterranean style sling and this style of armor and warriors, they were allowed to throw very far, because you're going at quite a distance, very high speeds. Now, the unique thing about the Eastern versus the Western, because they're all the same, is the ammunition used. What happens if your enemy is quite a far distance away? Well, your rock or whatever you're throwing is tumbling around while it's flowing through the air and it hits them. Okay, whatever. However, if you have a, quote, bullet-shaped rock, also known as a shoched or a almond shape, and you are flying it through the air, basic aerodynamics, what happens? It starts pointing itself out. And unfortunately for the Roman army, this was a quite devastating weapon because it killed a very large number of Roman soldiers when they started to attack the Assyrian Empire many, many generations from this point in time in history, because it pierces their armor. It's quite deadly. So Israel didn't have swords, did they? But were they completely defenseless? No. Shepherd's things you can braid together with nothing more than wool. They have sheep. It doesn't take a whole lot to braid things together. Rocks are readily available. They're quite easy to get a hold of. Every grown man, 20 years and older, most likely knew how to use one. So, were they terribly concerned by this? Of course they're concerned. They're terribly outnumbered. But it's not like they were completely defenseless. These people aren't incompetent soldiers. They know how to kill people from a distance. Yes, Hank.
They just had a military victory with Saul.
Yes, they did. And they didn't have swords. What did they use?
Spoons.
Rocks. Rocks. They're very good at it. Very good at it. Okay. I'm going to have to go a little faster because there's a whole topic which I have to get to, which is in verse 13. But anyway, so they're not completely defenseless at this point in time. We'll discover more detail about this particular shepherd's sling and the stones that David selected when he attacked Goliath later. Okay, they get into this band. Saul was concerned. 600 guys left. I got to do something. So what does he do? He takes in his own hands. He takes the burnt offering and the peace offering. He's able to offer the burnt offering, right? But he didn't get to the peace offering yet because Samuel shows up. By the way, the burnt offering happens before the peace offering, in case you aren't unaware of that. Burnt offering goes first, peace offering second. He finishes the burnt, Samuel arrives. Great, perfect time to do the peace offering. Samuel doesn't do it. Samuel says, what have you done? How much time did it save Saul by giving the burnt offering up and not waiting for Samuel?
Maybe a couple hours.
Maybe a couple hours, max. Too late to do anything that particular day anyway, as far as military is concerned. He gained himself a couple of hours. That's it. Some argue 3 hours. It depends on how long it takes to actually burn an animal outside. But if you begin a fire, you can burn a lot of things. So, yes, Ellie.
Well, it says, verse 8, according to the time set by Samuel. So he told him to wait.
7 days. 7 days. What point in time is 7 days? Yeah, what point in time during the day? Well, Samuel didn't specify that. A few hours is what he lost. And this is the point which Samuel gets to, which will discover my north part of my map up here. Samuel's response. Oh, first of all, let's go. Saul, of course, says, hey, I waited. You didn't show up. I, quote, fortified myself, or I got myself together. I said, all right, I'm going to do this because it needs to be done. I'd rather have it be wrong and do this as opposed to not do it at all. Not a bad reasoning, but not a good enough excuse. Reasons are not necessarily good enough to cause things or make things justify things. It doesn't work that way, especially with God. Samuel says, all right, verse 13, which is where I'm going to get to all this. My north half of my little map here I drew up. Samuel says to Saul, you've acted foolishly. You did not keep the commandment of the Lord your God that he commanded you. Until now, the Lord would have established your kingdom over Israel forever. When now your kingdom shall not endure, the Lord has sought a man after his own heart, and the Lord appointed him as ruler over this people, because you have not observed that which the Lord has commanded you. Then Samuel rose and went up from Gilgal to Gibeah Benjamin. Samuel did not give the peace offering. So was the peace offering done? No. Now, if I was in Saul's shoes, and I heard this from the person who outranks me, as far as God's concerned, that would be so demoralizing. I probably would have said, okay, I quit. Now, I'm not a very strong person, so don't get me wrong. He's obviously stronger than I was, because Saul didn't do that. Saul said, okay, Sam, yes, I made a mistake. Yes, you abandoned me. Yes, God's not with me anymore. But I'm not going to abandon. I'm not going to quit. I have to follow through with this. It's the right thing to do. Saul's not some coward. He's not some timid individual. He knew what was right. He knew what was wrong. He could have abandoned like I would have done. But he didn't. He stuck with it. Very strong individual to do so.
Is it pride?
No, not at this point. It's not pride. No, I don't think it's pride at this point. At this point, it's too late.
Pride would have been to leave.
Yeah, probably. I've been hurt. I've been ashamed. I'm embarrassed, but he doesn't do so. He sticks it out.
I think it goes back to the point you made about his character to begin with, that he's very practical.
He is.
Which means he's probably going to be very level-headed. He still understands the fortitude of the God that he serves. Mm-hmm. He practically knows there's no way out. He's been appointed to do something, and he's doing it, but the future plans have changed.
Exactly. Exactly. So things have changed, but he's still going to follow through with it, which is important. Because that's needed for the chapter 14, which we haven't gotten to yet. So, of course, it points out that, you know, all these people have left him and there's really nobody around. Jonathan leaves and takes how many with him? One man. His armor bearer. The guy who helps him with his armor. That's it. Nobody else knows that Jonathan has escaped. He, of course, shows up in chapter 14 as to what he's doing and where he's going. Which is important because, again, it shows a man after, if not God's heart, at least after David's heart. I don't know if it's necessarily after God's, but at least it was very similar to David's style of how he does things. So Samuel leaves, doesn't leave the offering. The people, the 600 that were left, still were willing to follow Saul. Shows they were willing to commit with their agreement, which they took with Samuel, said, oh, you go away from us. They're going to stick with what they got. And Samuel said, all right, you leave, and I'll give you a king. He's yours, whether you like him or not. All the problems come with it. They said, it's okay. We'll take him. And so they took it. Only 600 of them left with their slings. I'm sure they had bows and arrows too. Don't get me wrong. But they had just a few tools left to work with. Now let's go into why I have my little upper map here. Let's go back to verse 13. There is a contradiction in our Bibles. At least so it appears at first glance. Read this again. Samuel said to Saul, "You acted foolishly. You did not keep the commandment of the Lord your God. He commanded you. Until now, the Lord would have established your kingdom over Israel forever." Now, wait a minute. He can't do that. Saul's a Benjamite. Not from Judah. So you're saying, had Saul waited the extra 3 hours, we wouldn't be talking about King David or the Judah or anything about the Judahite kings? We talk about Benjamite kings. Establish your kingdom forever. Yes, Ellie.
Is that part of the change from Joseph to Judah?
No. No, it's a separate issue. I assume you're helping, but that's slightly different. It's slightly different. Slightly different. No, this is a separate problem that has occurred in our scripture Bibles. Those of you who have caught it, that's great. I didn't. I had to learn about it because it caught me off guard at first. This flies in the face of the prophecy explicitly given in Genesis chapter 49, verse 10. You don't have to go there, but you can if you wish. Referring to the scepter should not leave Judah's hand until the one to whom it belongs comes. That is a prophecy given to the tribe of Judah. And Judah himself, actually, obviously, the tribe of him, and of course, his descendants. So, how is it that the scepter was given to Benjamin and would have stayed with Benjamin, according to Samuel?
If he had obeyed.
It would have probably lived out his life and died.
His descendants, because, though. He would have included his descendants.
Well, because it says there, you know, ad olam, which means can mean as long as you last.
Well, that's possibly. Yes, Ellie.
You can have descendants from two tribes coming together. He would have had to been part of...
Brought Judah somehow back in biologically into Benjamin's line. But it still would have included Benjamin.
But here's the thing.
Yes.
Who is the real, not source of this prophecy, but the subject of it? Who is Shiloh? The one to whom it belongs. Is it really David, ultimately? No, it's the Messiah.
It's the Messiah.
So, you know, for God to say to Saul and to his descendants, you know, I'll give you this until he to whom it belongs comes. Until the Messiah, the one I've chosen as the Messiah, comes. And maybe that man, you know, it would have been a descendant of David or whoever, but even though they would have been more in the, they wouldn't have been very popular because Benjamin would have been the kings for generations, but still Judah was there. And they would have been having children and grandchildren and that. And so the Messiah still would be of the line of Judah. That would not change, regardless of who's...
That may be the case, but we wouldn't have the records of it.
And it says forever.
It does say forever.
It can't bounce.
It can't bounce. We'll get there. There's a reason why he brought this up. It wasn't so much. I could have said past it. The prophecy was given to Judah, right? It was not given to David yet. Because we think of, oh, well, David, God says to him, I will establish your kingdom forever. Well, David's not king yet. At this point in history, no one knows who David is. No one knows Jack about him. So the prophecies that occur at this point are irrelevant. So we're going to ignore those temporarily. Let's look at just past, up to their point. Because mind you, they can see what happened before them. They can't, as Richard pointed out, they cannot see what happens in their future.
That's right.
So they know what happened before them.
The literal word.
Exactly. What already happened. Well, another prophecy went to Judah. Okay. Well, yeah, and Judah's a tribe here. Ah. You know what? Funny things happened to Judah. Let's go back and read a few oddities that occurred to that particular man. Let's go back to Genesis. He is not quite simple as it may appear through Moses' time. This is in Genesis chapter 38. I'm going to read the whole chapter, just part of it. Chapter 38, starting out in verse... Well, I'll give you a basic rundown. Judas slept with his daughter-in-law. She has twins, Perez and Zerah, right? One pops out first, then goes back in, then the other one comes back out. So, okay, well, one is the line, Perez is the line where David comes from. The line of Perez. Well, guess what happened to Zerah, though? Because he was actually firstborn. Right? Now, I've talked to Richard about this previously. It's a little odd, but it's a unique scenario that God's so much smarter than we think he is. And so much better and more well put and kept and in a little kit and caboodle with a bowstring and type on top of it that we don't perceive how smart and talented he actually is. Because our little small minds focus upon the Bible, which is great. But there's one inherent problem with that. The Bible talks about one territory. Let's get a little green marker. The Bible talks about a little bit about Egypt, mostly about Israel, and a little smatterings here and there about Greece, and a speck or two about Italy and Rome. Well, you know, the Bible isn't the only book that exists or being written. Other people can record history too, right? If I can write words down, can't Jeff? Well, guess what? Jeff did. Well, not him personally, but that's what the other person did. More than one person wrote history down. That's how we have more than one witness. If I have a single person writing history, I have one witness. Well, that doesn't do me any good. If I have a counterbalance, somebody says, well, I witnessed from my perspective a little differently than you did. We saw the same events, but we just saw them different perspectives. That's how you determine things that are true or not true. How judges get, well, one guy's eyewitness versus another guy's eyewitness. They're not quite the same, but they're similar. Okay, we get enough information, we can make a verdict. Well, history is no different. So guess what? Egypt writes stuff too. So does Greece. So does Rome. Who would have thought? Guess what they wrote down? Zerah. Judah goes to Egypt, right, with all of his family, with a little E for Egypt on my little map. I didn't really draw because I had a short space. He goes to Egypt with his family. How many sons are with him?
Two.
Three. Three. The third child, who did not have very many descendants, and his two twin sons, Perez and Zerah. The other two kids, he had a total of five sons, are dead. God killed them because they were rotten scoundrels, in my opinion. So, my ever so humble opinion. So he goes down there with three sons. Well, according to the book of Chronicles, Zerah, one of his sons, has five more sons. 2 Chronicles, verse... I wrote it down here, hold a second here. Verse 4 through 6. Descendants of Zerah. And Perez, by the way, Perez comes back from Egypt in Moses' time. Guess what? Zerah does too. Well, not him personally, but his descendants. But not all of Zerah's descendants come back. Not all of his sons return from Egypt. To Israel, that is. They left Egypt, but not to Israel. Let's go read who his sons are. Well, Zerah's sons, according to 2 Chronicles, actually, I'm running out of space with no podium here. Let's see, get here real quick. Oops, that's 1 Kings. Wrong one yet. There it is. 2 Chronicles, verse 4. Tamar, this is, of course, Judah's daughter-in-law. 2 Chronicles, verse 4, or chapter 2, verse 4. Tamar's daughter-in-law bore Perez and Zerah. All of a sudden, Judah's were five. Now, of course, we already know the first two eldest died without giving children. The sons of Perez were Hezron and Hamul. The sons of Zerah were Zimri, also known as Zibdi, Ethan, Heman, Kalkul, and Dara. Five of them in all. So Zerah had five sons. Perez had, was it just two? To Haran? Yeah, two. David's line comes from Perez. We also know, however, Achan. Remember Achan back in the book of Joshua? He comes from Zerah's line. Achan, the guy, we don't like Achan because there's a valley named after him. Because he's the one, when they went into Jericho, he stole, he shouldn't have, and he hid in his tent. And God said, this is why, this is bad things. They killed him, and of course his whole family. Not all, a good chunk of his family at that point in time. So Achan comes from, if I have this written down correctly. Yes. Can you want the verse? In verse 7, the son of Carmi, which is one of from Zimri, was Achar, or also known as Achan, the troubler of Israel who transgressed the accursed things. The son of Ethan was Azariah. So guess what happened? Well, I'll tell you quite plainly what happened. We already know this much. I'm going to erase my little almond shape, which is more like a teardrop anyway, or blossom. There it is. I know this may seem tedious, but this is going to be very important to your personal lives. Because it'll affect the history which you didn't know, which I didn't know was true. I assume most of the note, because I didn't hear about it in history books. So Zerah has five sons. There's Zimri or Zabadi, whatever, same person's name, Zabdi, I think it's called. Ethan. Heman. Calcol and Dara. I'm not going to pay too much attention to Zabdi, Ethan, and Heman. Why? Because they came back with Moses. Crossed the Red Sea. They have descendants. We know about them. Who didn't come back? Calcol and Dara did not come back. How do we know they didn't come back? Because we know where they went. That's how we know they didn't come back. Egypt records history as well. Well, Egypt records people's names when things happen. They record an expulsion of all non-Egyptians, which, when you date it, depending on how you wish to date it, is actually very close to Moses' leaving of Egypt. They also record expulsion via the sea, kicking people off in ships to leave Egypt. Why? Because they said the gods, according to Egyptian records, the gods of Egypt were angry of Egyptians for not being pure to their worship. So they got rid of all the people who were not Egyptian. Hence, of course, you know, Moses leaves. So Egyptian records, if I got the guy's name right, Diordas Siculus. I'm not very good at people's names. But anyway, Caesar's a historian. Now, granted, he didn't live at this time. He's recording history much like Josephus did. It's about 400 BC when he's living. He's recording Egyptian history. He's actually not caring so much about Egyptian history so much as he's caring about Greek history. So this particular individual reports out that Egyptians spelled all foreigners. The most distinguished, however, followed a man called Darnus and Cadmus to Greece. The rest followed Moses, according to this particular individual. Like I said, 400 BC is about 1,000 years or so after the event. So we don't know exactly if dead perfect accurate. We don't too care about that. What we do care about is the phrase he said, the most distinguished followed Danus and Cadmus to Greece. Who are Danus and Cadmus? Well, a little bit of research, you find out who Danus and Cadmus are. Because those happen to be the language he was writing in that time, that's the translation of those names. According to Roman and Greek history, now this is not, you know, Israelite history, this is Roman and Greek history, two men with 50 others with them came from Egypt to what we currently call Greece. The two men's names were Dardanus and Cecrops. What did Dardanus do? Now, you might kind of similar to Darda a little bit. We'll get into what it actually is in a minute. It says Dardanus came and he built a city. Easy to do, flying around, whatever, boating around. With his, of course, by the way, Cecrops is his brother. And they came 50 men with them. Dardanus, he builds a city called Dardania. Why not? Name it after yourself. I'm in a town called Daniel. Sounds great. But Dardania wasn't the final name of that town. Dardanus had children. And by the way, he created Dardania, and guess what? He was the first king of Dardania.
It's good to be king.
Good to be king, yes. What happens according to Greek history? Not that y'all memorized all this stuff, but it took me a while to find it. Dardania is renamed Troy. Most of you have probably heard the Trojan Wars.
Yeah.
Guess what? That's that city. He named it Dardania. But it's recorded that his grandson renamed it Troy. But some argue it was his son. It's a little bit hard to identify which one actually renamed it. But either way, it's the city or town called Troy. What did Cecrops do? Well, Cecrops, Dardanus' brother, he went in a little town. He named a town after his wife. He named the town Athens. And he was the first king of Athens. This, of course, is Greek history. This is common knowledge. Nothing really fancy about it. Now, they say, according to Greek history, Dardanus is the son of Jupiter, the son of Cronus, the gods. Okay. Whatever that means. Who cares? Cecrops' brother would also be the son of Jupiter, the son of Cronus. Guess what? And Greek records him as being the son of Jupiter. They're both the son of Jupiter, son of Cronus. Okay, who cares? Josephus then comes along. 1 Kings, chapter 4, verse 21, 29 through 31. I know I'm jumping around a little bit, because these are where these people's names show up. 1 Kings in your Bible, 1 Kings chapter 4, verse 29. And it records, and God gave Solomon wisdom and exceedingly great understanding and largeness of heart like the sands of the seashore. Thus Solomon's wisdom excelled the wisdom of all the men of the east and all the wisdom of Egypt. For he was wiser than all the men of Ethan, the Ezrahite, and Heman, and Calcol, and Darda, the sons of Mahol, and his fame was in all the surrounding nations. What? Well, that's funny. Yeah. Ethan, Heman, Calcol, Darda. Josephus records this as Ethan, Heman, Cecrops, and Dardanus. Huh. So, according to this book we call the Bible, and according to Greek personal Greek history, the man who established the city of Troy and the city of Athens came from Egypt. And they're called Dardanus and Calcol, or Cecrops, according to Josephus. A Calcol and Cecrops, the same person. You may be asking, why do we care about all this? Because they're descendants of Judah. That's why we care. Contrary to our main thinking, at least my thinking was, maybe not all of yours, but I always focused upon Israel. Well, God's not that limited. He made the promise was made to Judah, not to Perez. It was to Judah. Well, Judah has more than one son. Just because David's line comes through Perez, and a kingly line goes through that process, doesn't mean he couldn't have selected Saul and say, you'll be king of Israel, that's okay, because the promise still held true. The kings of Troy and the kings of Athens were still kings. They died during some of this process, don't get me wrong. They live and die, and their descendants live and die. A few other things in history, which I don't get to all of them because it takes a lot of time, but I'd like to go through a little bit of it. Let's see here. Okay. According to Homer, You've heard of Homer's Odyssey, right? According to Homer, and according to Sanchuniathan, I'm not very good at his name, I apologize. These are both... Sanchuniathan is a Phoenician historian. He lived about 400 A.D. So he's a little bit older. See, so he's a little bit questionable there. Homer lived, of course, much earlier than him. Homer and Sanchuniathan record Dardanus as son of Jupiter, son of Cronos. But Sanchuniathan records, and of course, his Phoenician language, it says, well, Jupiter and Cronos, well, according to his word, Jupiter is what we as Phoenicians call Jedud, and Cronos, what we as Phoenicians call Israel. That's according to a Phoenician story. Now, granted, this is a long time ago, and it's not like they were there when they all happened. But the point is to record history, though. So the story goes this. Judah, with his nice, wonderful little promise, comes down to Egypt with three of his remaining sons that he had originally five. Most of them come back, but two don't. Why didn't they come back? Because they didn't need to go back to Moses. Why? Because they went through Troy and Athens. They went to Greece. Now, of course, you know about the Trojan Wars. You know Troy was destroyed. That's whatever. We'll discuss that shortly in a minute here. They are kings of those two nations. Now, does that mean all Greeks are Jews? Of course not. That would be ridiculous. That's silly. Calcol wasn't that foolish. The Cecrops, he wrote three laws when he created the king of Egypt, or king of Athens. The three laws were, there will be something called marriage to the people, the native people of Greece, what we call Yavanites. He also said there will be no human sacrifice. These are two of his laws he created when he created Athens. He also said there will be, quote, pure worship of God. Whether that means is debatable, because pure is very vague. He created those three laws. What else did he do? Well, he broke Greece up into 12 sections. Funny how he would have done that. Well, I'm going to write them along. 12 different categories of Greece. He named one of his 50 men brothers as kings of each of those sections. Sounds somewhat familiar. Sounds like a style, almost. A trademark. Not a foolish man, in my opinion. He does not stay in Greece, by the way. I mean, he personally does, but his descendants don't. They leave. As the Greek people, now that they have something called government, which they did not have at that point in time in history, they can learn to govern themselves. This is unusual to have a government. This is not common knowledge at that point in time in history. Yes, it was with the Egypt, but most countries did not have governments. You had city-states. That was it. Not actual regional governors. So it's quite unique. His descendants, of course, don't stay there. They leave and they move on. I'm not going to discuss where they all go to because that's a point of contention. But they leave. They make other cities, other regions further out through chunks of Europe. They are not European. They are just a group of people with Judah's history that come along and make governments. That's their trademark, actually. They make quite a few governments along their path. What does Dardanus do? Well, guess what? Well, the Trojan War has happened about a couple hundred years after he goes there. So they don't stay there for very long. But they aren't wiped out. Because the Trojan Wars, they did not kill the king of Troy. If those of you who recall the Trojan Wars, the king of Troy wasn't killed. He was banished. Yes, he did escape, but he wasn't allowed to return to that region either. So some would argue how far he had to escape. Well, guess where he went, which is occurring right at this moment in time in Samuel's history. The small town that he established. It was a pretty small town. It was no significant value. He called it Rome. He became king of Rome, by the way. Why not? Just wonder, what did he do in Rome? Well, let's take the sentence. If I can recall the first name, I would tell you, but I can't remember. It's something of Troy. I can't remember this first guy, the guy's first name. I didn't write it down. I should have, but I forgot to. So this guy whose title is, it's something like, you know, Odin of Troy or Bruce of Troy, whatever, something like that. He established a town called Rome, and he establishes something called the government of Rome. Guess what it was modeled after? The government he came from. Greek style governing.
Greco-Roman.
What do you call it?
Greco-Roman.
Greco-Roman. They established that way. These guys weren't stupid. They weren't foolish. They knew what they were doing, all descendants of Judah. How do they know this stuff? Yes?
I see through Judah, God is grafting in the Gentiles.
In many ways.
Yeah.
In many ways. Now, granted, these were the leadership. Not all the people... They didn't populate all this region. That's not the case. These regions were already populated. Italy, what we call Italy today, already had native people living there. Greece had native people living there. No government. No centralized government, I should say. Yeah, they had city-states. That's no different. That's every had city-states. But centralized government, which is more of an Egyptian style, also known as what we call a biblical style government, didn't exist. So they established them. Well, they don't stay in Rome either. They establish Rome. They establish a city government state that actually has a regional governing. And of course, we already know Rome's history. It comes and goes. They didn't stay. Where did they go? Well, because when Rome went from kings to Caesars and went from government to killing everybody, as far as killing the leadership... They didn't want to stick around, and who could blame them? I wouldn't want to stick around either. So, yeah, very much so. So the people of Rome, the people who established Rome, the descendants of Troy, and granted, this is all recorded down. We already know from genealogy all the way down to Dardanus, the people who established Rome, they have them all the way traced down to Dardanus. That's pretty simple. It's common knowledge. It's very readily available for anybody to look up. It's recorded in multiple locations. So that's nothing I do. I'm not judging my opinion here yet. This is just historical information. So the people of Rome, one individual, had to leave Rome for obvious reasons because Romans killed their leaders as opposed to just electing new ones. Apparently, they didn't quite get the whole concept of election yet, but they figured it out eventually after they got wiped out. He established another city called Troinovant, which means New Troy. Troinovant is not on my map. This particular individual called Bruce of Troy was his name. I used him as a reference earlier, meaning because I don't recall the name of the person who established Rome. But Bruce of Troy left Rome. He was like 16 or 17 generations after Dardanus. He leaves Rome and establishes a city called Troinovant, which means New Troy, to start over again. Establishes a government in Troinovant. Now, we don't know what Troinovant is. I don't recognize that name. Do any of you recognize the name Troinovant? Susan may have if she was here, but she left. It's likely she would have recognized the name. We know it as its modern-day name. He was king of Troinovant, and of course his descendants were, of course, some of you. We call Troinovant London.
Yep.
Now again, this is all just recorded history. Now I'm going to inject my personal opinion into it. I'm stepping out of my little historical lesson, going history, now my personal opinion. I think God was smarter than I thought he was before. He wasn't isolated just to Israel. It appears, as far as this is just plain recorded history, it appears he actually focused upon the promise given to Judah. It doesn't matter to him whether it was Perez or Zerah. It appears he went to both. Both lines. Exactly. He established both of those kingdoms. Holy cow. I never thought about that. He's smarter than I thought he was. I know. Kind of weird. But so.
Well, thousands of years later, who hasn't heard of all those places?
Well, yeah, we all know them. And we all know they had kings. Exactly. We focus upon Israel and how God influenced Israel and Palestinian territory and the Canaanites and Canaanites. Well, God is a lot bigger than this. Yes, Richard.
There was I don't remember where I got my notes in the Torah, but or prophets, but it says that when God began the creation, he divided the sons of Adam
according to
the number of the sons of Israel. Yes.
And there you have a division.
Yes, you do.
So London was divided and separated for one reason.
To maintain that Judah's line would be a kingship.
Right.
So wait a minute. The Messiah didn't come to London.
Right.
It doesn't have to. It doesn't matter. As long as he came through Judah's line and it was a kingship, it would be okay. Now, so this promise that Samuel gives to Saul, could that have been true? Well, yeah, God could have made that true. Would it have blown apart the whole master plan? Of course not. God's bigger than that. He's a lot smarter than that. He had split the family up. There's a reason why Perez was called the breach. This was abnormal. There, Zerah stuck his hand out and got the red cord, and Perez came out first instead. This is a new. Why is this recorded in history? Why is it recorded in our Bibles? They could have just said he had twins. They didn't say he had twins. He recorded how it happened. Yes, there are other more detailed analysis of this, but I'm doing it not justice, but unfortunately I went over quite a bit of my time, so I apologize for that. I had you read Samuel chapter 1, 2, and 3. I know this may be a little bit off topic after what I just covered, but it's still important to cover. Well, first of all, are there any questions about this little spiel of history? Yeah. Well, yeah, there may be questions. Questions that I know how to answer. Now, granted, all the stuff's available on Google search. You can look it up online. It's not that uncommon. It's quite common knowledge. Or not common knowledge. It's commonly available. Yes.
How come in Kings it said Zerah ben Hemah, the son of Shaul?
Son of Mahol. Those aren't the sons of Mahol. There's another category, sons of Mahul. Let's see here. Mahul was a guy further east than them. He had... I'm running out of map on my map. I'm going to erase a good chunk of this, so... I could, but then no one could see it, because only you could see it. It would be close to you at the bottom of my map, but nobody up top could see it. So there are all the sons of Zerah, Ethan... There was Chiman, there was Kalkol, Dark. Who else did I say this morning? And sons of Mahul. It's just another category of men. Not that these were the sons of Mahul. It's smarter than these guys, smarter than these guys, smarter than these guys, smarter than these guys, smarter than these guys.
Okay.
The way it's worded, it sounds like these were somehow the sons of him. No. It's... These guys, including the sons of Mahul as well, he was smarter than all of them, or wiser than all of them, I should say. It's another category. I know in our English it puts them like that. I was like, well, but this doesn't make sense. Well, it's because that's the way English write it. It's another category, the sons of Mahul. Sons of Mahul is a guy further east. We categorize him as a descendant of Ur, that area, an Assyrian, further east. Yes, Carmel.
I missed all that. Could you start over?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Okay. So, okay, I've got to finish off my last two little syllables here, practically. There's a problem that occurred, which I don't know if you caught that or not. Probably not. But, I'll go back. Anyway. 1 Samuel 14, verse 3. Saul calls forth a Kohen Gadol, the high priest. And who is the high priest? It says he is Ahiah, the son of Atub, the brother of Ichabod, who was the grandson of Eli. Now, wait a minute. With the story of Shiloh and the destruction of Shiloh, the town, Eli and God promised, you and your descendants will be wiped out. You will not be high priest anymore. How is it that this guy is high priest and Saul's king? Is God's word not true?
Is it out of order?
Well, not exactly. See, it's a question about simpler than what it looks. You see, God's word says you will not be high priest. Well, high priest requires a temple. It requires an ark. It requires a whole bunch of other things to come with it. And your duties are associated to. Well, at this point in history, the ark... is still in Abinadab's house in Kirjath Yearim, which I erased my map, unfortunately, which is south of Jerusalem. There is no temple. So is this man actually high priest? Well, genetically, that's it. So God's word is not that it's not true, it's that the replacement of the high priestly line has not occurred yet because the temple has not been built yet, meaning rebuilt. Because David is the one who rebuilds it. David and Solomon, they continue it on. So, yeah, he's a high priest, meaning that he's a descendant of, and he's wearing the ephod, because then he has no job. Yes, Jeff.
Well, I seem to have done a good job consulting Saul on waiting until the
clearly he wasn't. Clearly he needs some education.
Why that line was removed.
Yeah. Yeah, they're not very talented people when they pay attention. less than 20 years. At this point, about 10 years from now is when David moves the ark over to the new house that he builds for him. So about 10 years from this point, or well, more like 9. But he's around. Yes, the biological descendant guaranteed he's under the age of 40 because we're supposed to be dead by the age of 40. They all die pretty young from line of Eli onward. But nothing more than the fact the temple doesn't exist. That's why this guy's name shows up. I want to point that out now because when I cover chapter 14 the next time I'm up here, it's going to be too much time to jumble all this stuff into one little session.